Good afternoon, everyone. Let me thank Satya and Professor Joshi for making this happen. It's a little odd. I'm giving a talk where there's nothing fundamental in it. Perhaps there's no research in it, even though a couple of pieces out of this have appeared as journal articles. But I will not call that really research. My talk yesterday at IIT was on a topic that I do, and I can call that as research, but this is not research. In America, all universities pretty much have what they call a statistical consulting center. And if a university doesn't have it, there is something wrong. They should all have it, and most of them have it. And the consulting center is open to not only the students and faculty on that campus, but it's sort of open to some extent to the community also. And so much of the stuff I'm going to talk about here has kind of come out of those consulting relationships that I have had, and similarly my colleagues will have different stories to tell, and professors at other universities may have other cases to talk about. So this is what I have. I think many of these things may be already familiar to you, but I thought I'll still talk about the basic difference between statistics and mathematics, although it's a very difficult thing to do, but I'll try to describe this in simple terms. And then statistical studies. It's very important to know ahead of time what you want to do so that you can design the study appropriately. Most times, people come to us for help when they have already collected the data. Study had already been designed, data have already been collected, and now they come to us and they say, can you help? And you can help only so much. And therefore, studies have to be designed carefully. And then this term, statistical significance, that's the key. Sometimes some evidence has a lot of practical significance, but it has no statistical significance. And the other way around, statistically something could be significant, but at a practical level, it has absolutely no value. For example, if a professor every day comes to the class where 50% of the students are boys and 50% are girls, and the professor says that randomly I'm going to give a chocolate to one student, randomly, and first day the chocolate goes to a female student. Well, there was a 50% chance that could have happened. Second day also it goes to a female student. So what's the probability it happens 2 days in a row? Well, 0.5 times 0.5, so there's a 25% chance it could have happened. It happened the same way the third day. So 3 days in a row, the chocolate goes to a female student. Fourth day, the chocolate goes to a female student. So when is it that there is strong evidence of a gender bias now? So that the guys start complaining that there is something wrong here. And believe it or not, if it happens 4 days in a row, it's not enough bias yet. But if it happens on the fifth day, then you cross the threshold. And now somebody can sue the professor and say that this professor indulges in gender bias. So this issue is a important issue, and most of the consulting work we do, some of that takes us in a court of law where there's a fight going on between two parties and you are representing one of them. And then the statistical significance threshold, that becomes the key. And you have to explain to the court that why this is so important a issue and has that threshold been crossed or not. So we'll do that. And then I'll talk about some applications. This is one big issue these days, data confidentiality and respondent privacy. And this is where I work really. In some way, my research is related to respondent privacy. But data confidentiality and respondent privacy, there are a lot of connections between the two, and then there are a lot of dissimilarities also between the two. And these days, there is more and more demand from funding agencies that when you collect data, you need to share your data with public at large. So on one hand, you are bound by some ethical pledges, but at the same time, you need the money. And so the funding agencies will want you to release your data. So how do you do that? So in releasing the data, they try to disturb the data a little bit so that confidentiality can be maintained, but they cannot disturb too much because then the data quality is lost. So they have to disturb, but they cannot disturb too much. So it's a huge topic. And these days, everybody talks about big data, because look around anywhere, there are tons and tons of data. And therefore, this masking, demasking problem becomes a big deal. So I'll talk a little bit about that. And these RRT models feed into this respondent privacy. So RRT is short for randomized response technique, RRT. So I'll just talk about this a little bit. But this is the last part is what got Pankaj's attention. He was visiting our university earlier this year, and I was telling him some of the stories coming out of this. And he seemed interested in that. And when I sent him a couple of three possible topics for my talk, he chose this one. He said, well, why don't you speak on that? Because research talks at this institute, you get to hear every day. But maybe this is a little different. So this is the plan. As far as differences between mathematics and statistics, in mathematics, conclusions are driven by precise models. But in statistics, conclusions are often data-driven. And the funny thing is that in math, whatever conclusions are made today, they remain valid tomorrow, they'll remain valid day after, and so on. But in statistics, one person draws one conclusion about a population, another person draws a completely different conclusion about the same population because the data they collect might be different. So my data makes me say so and so. Somebody else's data makes that person say maybe something slightly different. So whatever I'm saying based on the data that I collected. So it's some sort of data-driven thing. In mathematics, we make statements with no room for error. So when I did my PhD in mathematics, I used to make fun of my statistics colleagues that what do you mean by I'm 95% sure? Now who is going to take care of the other 5%? So if you're looking for a 100% accurate statement, then statistics is not for you. Go somewhere else. So in statistics, there is always this little room for error that you have to tolerate. And there's no such thing in mathematics. Also in mathematics, we make statements like X is greater than Y. But in statistics, the statement is more like X is significantly greater than Y. So the word significant is very important. So if at a campus, the male GPA is 3.2 and female GPA is 3.4, can you say that the female students on that campus are smarter because their GPA was 3.4 compared to male GPA of 3.2? Well, obviously, 3.4 is more than 3.2. But the key is it significantly more than 3.2? So that becomes the issue. So the talk, the language that we use is a little different in statistics. As far as the statistical studies are concerned, there are various kinds. One of them, the very basic one, is descriptive studies, where you just collect data and do small things, basic summaries, etc., and you report those summaries, and you can detect some trends. But you cannot make too much noise about what you did, because at the end of the day, it's something very basic. And then there are the inferential studies, where you collect some data randomly from a target population. You analyze the data and make inference about the target population. Now, that's the real statistics. So there's a population, target population. You randomly draw a sample, analyze the sample, and you can extrapolate your results. Whatever you see in the sample, you can extrapolate that to the whole population. So that's your inferential studies. One of the work, consulting work I used to do for various biotech companies, particularly one biotech company, I can't name it. So they would manufacture these diagnostic test kits, which will detect presence of antibiotics in milk and many other things. Now, one might wonder, why should antibiotics be there in milk? Now, what happens is that the cow gets sick, and the cow is treated, and the farmer is told not to milk the cow, of course, but then throw away the milk. But sometimes the greed takes over, and you sell the milk a little too quickly. So adding water in milk is okay. Actually, water-added milk is more expensive in the U.S. than pure milk. I mean, not exactly, but they have this thin milk and very thin and fat added milk. So that's not their concern, less concern. The more concern is, are there dangerous things, antibiotics in milk? And so the company will make about 500,000 test kits in one lot. And you cannot sell it just like that. First, you need to do in-house testing, and that's where I come in. So they run their protocol, and they give me the numbers. I run the numbers and say that, well, FDA protocol has been met now. So you can now approach FDA that please do our testing. We are very happy with on our end. And then FDA will ask for samples of those test kits from that lot. And when they run their analysis, either they'll come back and tell you that, okay, you can release the lot, or they'll tell you, stop, you have to trash it. You cannot sell it because it does not meet the specification. Now, one of the case studies I'm going to show you today is exactly on the topic that one of the products of the company was rejected by FDA. And we argued, and we convinced them that you made a mistake. But FDA is FDA. They didn't want to reverse their decision, and the company didn't want to sue FDA because they told me that this is not the only product we have. We have more product, and we deal with FDA all the time, so we don't want to mess around with them. So, but there's more to that story. I'll tell you as we go along. Then there's observational studies. Here you analyze the data that was not collected randomly. So because the data was not collected randomly, inference cannot be made in these cases. But most importantly, causation cannot be claimed. Now, I think many of you may be familiar with this famous Space Shuttle Challenger disaster data, 1986. I don't know the date offhand, but I was on a plane that day coming back from my first job interview from Boston, and that's when the space shuttle exploded. And everybody knows why it happened. It's just that the temperature that morning was very cold. The launch should not have happened, but it did happen because there was some pressure. There was some VVIP who was going to watch the launch, so they went ahead with the launch. So it happens in America also, and the shuttle never came back. And the suspicion, very strong suspicion, and we teach that case study in our classes, suspicion is that because of the cold temperature, the O-rings malfunctioned. And that created the mess. So people know that there is a linkage here. But you cannot claim causation that it's that which caused the crash. So that connection cannot be made. And therefore, in spite of the fact that there is so much evidence, nobody went to jail for what happened that day, only because it was a observational study. They looked at the 24 launches that had happened up to that point, and they looked at the temperatures and all of that stuff. So there was evidence, but since the experiment was not set up in such a way that causation can be claimed. And in order to do that, you need to set up the experiment carefully. And then if you see group differences, you can claim some causation. For example, you have a whole bunch of monkeys, and that's where this cloning might be very useful. So you have some monkeys in group A, some monkeys in group B. Genetically, they are identical. But one group is treated one way, and the other group is treated differently, and you see some effect. And now you can claim that, well, the treatment caused that effect, because otherwise there was no reason for there to be any effect at all, because they were identical. And so causation can be claimed or cannot be claimed becomes an important issue. And oftentimes what happens is that people come to us, as I said earlier, when it's already too late. They already have data, and they want to make some story out of the data. And we do the analysis for them or guide them to do the analysis, but also tell them the limitations. Statistical significance, generally speaking, a finding is called statistically significant. If the chance of seeing that finding or even more extreme finding just by chance is less than 5%. Now, some people are not too happy about 5%. They set a lower threshold, but in courts, some of the cases I'm going to talk about are court-related cases. 5% is the standard benchmark. So if you can show that the evidence has attained that 5% significance level, or you have gone below that, then you can say that, well, I have proved my case. So it's basically the probability of seeing what you saw, or even more extreme evidence, less than 5% of the time. So that's when you call that finding to be significant. This is the stuff where, you know, I just brought it in because I work in this area, scrambling and de-scrambling. It happens on two ends. A lot of time when you're collecting data, you have to offer the respondent some privacy. Otherwise, why will the respondent cooperate with you? One of the problems in America, high schools, it may be here also, I don't know. It was not so in my time when I was in high school. But drug use by students is a big issue. Now, how do you find out who is doing drugs and who is not doing drugs? So you can do a survey, but why will the student tell you whether or not he or she is doing drugs? So you have to offer some sort of a privacy. Actually, even after offering that privacy, they may still not tell you the truth. But without offering any privacy, they're not going to tell you what's going on. So that's called scrambling. And then at the end, once data have been collected, you have to do de-scrambling also. So you have to explain to the respondent that de-scrambling cannot happen at individual level. It can happen at an aggregate level, but not at an individual level. And our interest also is what's happening at the aggregate level. We want to find out if the high school has a major drug problem. What percent of students there are indulging in that behavior? We are not interested in whether this or that student is doing it. That's their parents' job or somebody else's job. But as a public administrator, they want to find out how big the problem is at a particular school so that some intervention, you know, can be planned. Texting and driving is a major issue. Actually, I'm working with the City of Greensboro Police Department trying to figure out what's the prevalence of that behavior. Now, if it turns out that the prevalence of texting and driving by high school students is very small, why invest money in doing some sort of intervention? But if you find that there's a big problem, then a major intervention has to be launched. And so it's important to have a good feel for what's happening. So this is a front-end problem when you're collecting data. You need to be careful about it. But this also becomes a back-end problem and under the name data confidentiality. So once data have been collected, as I was saying earlier, now data has to be released. Many times you're forced to release the data. And when you're releasing the data, you have to scramble the data in some way. And scrambling, de-scrambling will come later, but scrambling has to be done in such a way that you don't compromise the quality of the data too much. So some quality will be lost. Actually, it's almost like going in opposite side. In order to create greater confidentiality, the scrambling has to be more. And when there's more scrambling, then obviously the quality has to be compromised. So in order to get more of something, there is less of something else. So we have to sort of live with that. Synthetic data is becoming a big deal. That's where computer scientists are coming into play. So you have data. Now, before you release the data, you try to get a synthetic copy of that data. Now, I don't know how they do it, but computer scientists, they can create a copy of their data, which has a lot of the same properties, whichever way you look at, but it's not the real data. And therefore, you cannot find out who is who. Actually, one student wrote a PhD thesis on violating data privacy. So much so that from the voter records in Massachusetts, she was able to identify 97% of the folks in that database accurately, including the governor of Massachusetts. She was able to say that, actually, the story started from medical data from some hospital, and she was able to identify 87% of those, 97% on the other side, but so 87% of the so-called anonymized data, she was able to crack it. And governor of Massachusetts, she was able to point out that, look, so much for the confidentiality, this is you. And so it's an important thing. So this is becoming an important subject where the data is completely swapped by artificial data. And it has the similar properties. And people then can play around with that data. Let me talk a little bit about this randomized response model. This is the area that I work with. It's scientific alternative to bogus or pseudoscientific methods. You may not believe it, but some people use very strange methods to make you tell the truth or to get to the truth. And this is, I'll tell you a small story which actually prompted my interest in this field. My doctoral work was in time series forecasting. And I stopped doing that in 2000. And from 2000 on, it's all survey sampling. And in psychology, sociology, in surveys, people ask a lot of very private questions, which respondents will not feel comfortable answering. So they somehow make you believe that if you lie, my computer is going to detect your lie. And it's all bogus. And so, I mean, it's a long story. But they trick the respondent into believing that if you lie, the computer is going to catch you. And so after instilling that fear in them, then they say, okay, now I'm turning off the audio of my computer, but the computer is still recording your responses. And so they scare them into telling the truth. And I call that to be a bogus or a pseudoscientific method. And these models have been around, you know, for the last 50 years. And many variations have come up in the past 50 years. Different people come up with different RRT models. We have done our bit in proposing some models. This is the original model. And just to give you a little feel for how privacy can be offered to respondents, you can ask a question directly or you can ask a question indirectly. For example, asking someone the question that, did you file a fraudulent tax return last year, right? So that's one way. The other is, did you file a correct return last year? So in my deck of cards, I have two kinds of cards. Some cards have the question, did you file a correct return, income tax return last year? And some cards have the question, did you file a fraudulent tax return last year? So I come to somebody, the person draws a card, and I say, respond to the question on the card. So if the person says yes, now I don't know if he's saying yes to filing the correct return or yes to filing a fraudulent return, right? And so this is called indirect, questioning method. And this is now taught in undergraduate courses, but when the paper appeared, it was a big news, and there are thousands and thousands of citations of this paper. And you can see that if pi is the proportion of people who actually filed fraudulent returns, and suppose P is the proportion of cards which ask that question. So what's the probability somebody will give you a yes response? Well, it can happen two ways. He got the fraudulent return card, and the prevalence of that is this. So that's one piece. Or you get the other card, and the probability of not indulging in that behavior is 1 minus pi. So you can find out this. And in this equation, P is something that you created. Pi is the only unknown. This is very easy to estimate. All you have to do is look at the proportion of yes responses in your sample, and you're done. Excuse me. Yes.
Assume that person is still speaking the truth. Response is...
Say that again.
It assumes that person is responding, but it's still speaking the truth.
Well, speaking the truth, following the instructions, meaning in the person is speaking the truth. Actually, in psychology, there is this issue of self-deception. There are two issues. There's the issue of personality management or impression management, and there's the parallel issue of self-deception. For example, if you ask somebody that, have you ever hit your child? Now, you don't want to look bad to society, so you lie. Now, that's called impression management. But if the question is, are you overweight or do you have a drinking problem? Even if you do, they lie to themselves actually that, no, I don't have a drinking problem or I don't have a weight problem. So what happens is that in these kinds of situations, there's a possibility. A person, in spite of all your pleadings, in spite of all your instructions, may not tell the truth. And therefore, you have to live with that.
Right. That equation is valid only if that's...
Yes, you're right. Now, what we do is that when we do the surveys on campus, we don't do the survey on day one. So we go on day one and give a lecture on RRT and raise questions of this kind. We plead with them, please, if you don't feel comfortable, you know, don't have to answer. But if you want to answer, you have to play by the rules. But some people, they may still not follow the rules and may give you wrong answer. Actually, giving no answer is better than giving wrong answer. And so that's a problem. So that previous equation that I showed you is easy to solve, and you can get your estimate for the prevalence, assuming that people told the truth. There was a model that came in 1969, and this is the Greenberg et al. Unrelated question model. Greenberg's theory was that in Warner's case, you're still asking the touchy question. Whether you ask it directly or you ask indirectly, it's dealing with cheating on taxes, right? Keeping that example in mind. So people still feel nervous about dealing with that subject. So Greenberg said, what if you throw in a completely unrelated question in the mix? For example, one question is, have you cheated on taxes? Yes or no? And some of the cards will have the real question, and some of the cards will have the question, were you born between January and April? So there's nothing personal about that second question, right? And so it increases the cooperation. And you can go through the math and find out the probability of a yes response. And you can do that fairly easily. I think the point was to show you that sometimes very, you know, complex looking things, you can still deal with those by clever statistical planning. One thing that I have done a lot of is optional models, where the scrambling, you don't force anyone to give you a scrambled response. Sometimes people are very bold, and they're willing to give you a correct answer in your face. Actually, once I was teaching a class, Stat 101, and I gave an example that asking a woman how many kids you have is okay, you know, she will not hesitate to answer that question, but asking her how many abortions you have had, the woman is not going to reply to that. And one female student actually stood up and said, what makes you think so? And she was actually very upset that I would say something like that, because abortion right is a big issue in America, perhaps at other places too. She actually said that in class, that it's my life, it's my body, I can do what I want to do, why should I be ashamed of having gone through that? So that actually gave us the idea of optionality, meaning you tell the audience that this is my question. If you feel that this is no big deal for you, just answer truthfully. But if you feel that no, something like this, not just for you, but in general, that question is too touchy to be asked directly, then you give me a scrambled response. So some people will give you a truthful response, some people will give you a scrambled response. You don't know who gave you the truthful response, who gave you the scrambled response. So now my job is double. Not only I have to find the prevalence, but out of curiosity, I also have to find out what proportion of people chose to scramble. That is the sensitivity level of that question, which I call W. So there are two things in my model. What proportion of people chose to give you a scrambled response, and what's the prevalence of that behavior? And rather than going into this, let me show you some applications of these two models, the Warner's model and Greenberg model. These are real life examples, actually. There was a study in Germany where the conjecture was that more educated people are more tolerant of foreigners, which on the face of it sounds correct, but somebody wanted to check what the extent of that is. And we launched one study on our campus where actually our motivation was different. We wanted to see that this complex optional RRT model that we created, does it even work? Can it be implemented? But then we took an interesting problem to try that on. So in one case, Warner's model is used, in the other case, the Greenberg model is used. And here, look at this. Under direct questioning, without any RRT, 75% of the highly educated, so-called highly educated, expressed the opinion that they don't have any issues with foreigners living in Germany. So acceptance for foreigners was 75%, and among the less educated, the acceptance was 55%. So this is based on no RRT, direct questioning, that do you have any problem if foreigners come and live here? So, but the same study was repeated using RRT. And see what happened. The 75% became 53, and the 55% became 24. So the direction is still the same, that more educated people are more tolerant of foreigners living in their country. But the level of glory has gone down. So the acceptance from 75% came down to 53%. Now, nobody knows what the truth is because this is done. Now, this one is subject to response bias. This one is subject to what he pointed out, that people may still not be telling you the truth. But at least there is evidence that the real extent of, or the real prevalence of the so-called educated people being more tolerant of foreigners may not be as high as it sounds. In our study on our college campus, we had two questions. One was, have you ever been told by a healthcare professional that you have a sexually transmitted disease? Have you been diagnosed with that? And so it's a yes-no question. The other was, how many persons you have had sex with in the last 12 months? So both are very touchy, private questions. Which one do you think is more private? Diagnosis of STD or admitting or answering a question on how many persons you have had sex with? Which one is a more personal personal question? Actually, it turns out that more people thought I should not be discussing my STD story with anyone. And how many persons I have had a relationship with is less touchy a issue. But these were the two things that we did. And there were 878 subjects. And we tried actually three things. Remember I mentioned that nobody knows the truth in Germany survey? And this is a real thing that we did. But our objective was not to find out the extent of these behaviors on my campus. The objective was that this model that we created, does it work? And so we have three groups. In one group, we use the checkbox survey method. That is, you answer the question privately, drop it in a box, and go. And we believe that there is no reason for somebody to lie on that unless somebody is somehow indulging in self-deception. The other is a direct face-to-face interview. And we believe that a lot of truth will be compromised here. People don't want to discuss that with you. So we thought this is the truth. This is a lot of truth violated. And this is the model that we had proposed. By the way, I should tell you that this work was done by undergraduate students. Now, in America, this is becoming a big deal. Every campus has this, something called an undergraduate research office. And students are doing research left and right. National Science Foundation has a program called REU, Research Experience for Undergraduates. So some couple of students under that REU took this project and published their paper. But this story was interesting. And see what happened. In face-to-face interview, only 2% students said that, yes, I have been diagnosed with STD. But look at the anonymous method, 9%. So a lot of truth has been compromised. But when we used the optional RRT, the prevalence was somewhere around like 3.5%, 4%. So the point was that such a question, if you ask face-to-face, be prepared for response bias. So you have to come up with something. Now, somebody might say, why would you not always use the anonymous checkbox method? A big problem in statistics is non-response. People don't want to respond to your surveys. The best way to get the information is you catch them. They're right in front of you. You ask them the question. But then you cannot ask the question directly. You have to indulge in that scrambling, de-scrambling game. So there is that story, and this is the question I had asked you. As far as the STD history, have you been diagnosed with STD? 77% of the folks thought that question is very private, and about 61% of the respondents felt that telling somebody about number of sexual partners last year is a private issue. So obviously there's more here. Another undergraduate student actually used that data and mined it a little bit more. And she wanted to find out, okay, so we know that there is an issue of STD in general. So what causes it? Well, public health people already know what causes it. But we wanted to still see some evidence in the data that we had collected. And we found that the age, gender, and number of sexual partners, they all have a very significant impact on somebody being diagnosed with STD. Age, the risk goes up by about 21% with each additional year of age. Now, that sounds strange. But this is like these college students coming as a freshman. They don't have too many friends yet, but now they become sophomores, so they have had more friends and some more opportunities. So with each additional age in college, the risk of STD goes up by about 21%. Now this is remarkable that a female has 20 times the risk a male does, all else being equal, same age, same number of sexual partners. But a female has 20 times the risk that a male does. And each additional sexual partner, the risk goes up by about 63%. Now, somebody may already have known these things, but what we want, what the student, like what can you give to an undergraduate student to work on? And students are always looking for some project, because that makes a difference in them being accepted at Harvard or Yale or to University of Massachusetts. So everybody these days is a good student. They're trying to do something. Even high school students have started doing research, actually, so that they can be accepted at a better school. Graduate, undergraduates are doing it so that they can be accepted at a better school when they go for graduate work. Let me now get into this, what I call the beautiful world of statistical consulting and some real studies. Now, this is the dreaded organization in the US, Food and Drug Administration. It's not as bad as I'm making it sound. They, whatever you are doing, if it has something to do with you know, the food, then it has to be approved by FDA. You cannot just go ahead and start selling those things. And these test kits. So people there, the companies which manufacture these test kits, which can detect contamination in milk, water, this, that. And so the sensitivity of a test kit has to cross certain threshold. And similarly, there is specificity. So I'm defining these two terms for you. So sensitivity is the probability of the result coming out positive if the sample is actually contaminated. And specificity is the result actually coming out negative when the sample is not contaminated. And the protocol is this. At the sensitivity level, FDA required that the test kit, it should show a sensitivity of at least 90%, and you should be 95% sure about it. Now, when I first started helping this company, this is where they were stuck. That, Professor, what do you mean by saying that the sensitivity has to be at least 90%, and you better be 95% sure about it? Well, they can run their test in-house and see out of 100 samples how many of them were detected. If that number is more than 90%, you're done. But obviously, there is a sampling error, so you have to factor that in and see, do you remain above 90% even after you factor in the statistical fluctuation? So explaining that to these companies or people who are doing the work there is not all that easy. And now, it's a common practice for people indulging in these kinds of businesses to have some statisticians on board who can do this work in-house. So formal test of compliance. So I'm saying that in a randomly selected sample of test kit, sensitivity should be greater than 0.90 after accounting for statistical uncertainty. Now, I'm leading into a real, you know, case study. And suppose n is the number of contaminated samples, and suppose that number is 20. And you tested them, and of course, the tester didn't know. Typically, it's mixed. So there are contaminated samples and there are clean samples, and just 1 second. So the person who is testing it doesn't know which samples are contaminated, which samples were clean. But at the end of the day, they want to see how many of the 20 contaminated samples were captured. So yes.
Is there a
Can you speak a little louder, please?
Is there a
Well, again, I don't know whether they should be equal or they should not be equal. I'm just saying that the
even the test is positive,
well, these are just two different issues. For example, at FDA, what they say is that the clean samples, even one, you by mistake call positive or done, the product is lost. You cannot sell the product. So the specificity part is very strict. The sensitivity part is where they concentrate on. And they say that in a random mix, somebody knows which 20 samples were contaminated. Did you catch all of them, or how many did you catch? You know, that's the issue. So I'm concentrating on the sensitivity side of it. Specificity has a, even though what I gave you, that's the protocol, but their application is a little different. And so the question here is this, that your technician using this test were able to catch all of them. There were 20 samples which were contaminated. All of them were caught. So is it good enough? Well, the sample sensitivity is 100%, but is it enough? But if you look at the p-value, what's the probability that the actual sensitivity is less than 90%, like 0.899 or something, and something like this happened just by chance? And there's a 12% chance something like that could have happened. So there goes your compliance is not good now. So catching 20 out of 20 doesn't take you there. Catching 25 out of 25 doesn't take you there. But catching 30 out of 30 is going to take you there. If you had 30 samples which were contaminated and all of them were caught, then the sample sensitivity is this. The p-value comes out to be 0.0424, so you are below that 5% threshold. So now you can say that the FDA compliance has been met. But here's the, this is the real story. So in an actual test, in-house testing we did, we found that the FDA guidelines are being met. So then we submitted these test kits to FDA. We submitted, you know, you can do the math, 60 plus 30 plus 30. There was 30 here, but one was dropped, 30 here, 30 here. So what FDA does is it spikes these samples. 60 of them, they will not spike. 30 of them, they were spiked with 3 parts per billion of amoxicillin. 30 of them, they added 4 parts per billion and so on. And as I said, for some reasons, technical reasons, some of the samples were dropped because they could not be tested. So this is the data. Based on this data, FDA came back and told my company meaning the company I used to do consulting for, they said you cannot sell this product. Now that's a big news, because when the verdict comes out, the company's stock value actually goes down. It brings bad name to the company. And I said, well, I mean, what can I do? Remember, I told you that in mathematics, conclusions today are valid tomorrow also. But in statistics, one person does something in a very valid manner, gets one result. Somebody else does something in a very valid fashion, but gets a different result. So the conclusions are data-driven. I said, whatever I told you was based on what I did. What is FDA doing? There could be some sampling variation, so I don't know what happened. So the FDA was actually preparing the samples not in a, in an ideal manner. So the company's focus was complaining to FDA that you did not prepare and test the samples properly. That's where the trouble is. And FDA will not listen. And one day, I don't know why, well, I know why, some student was looking for a project. A master's student was looking for a graduate project. And I had this data with me, and I said, just see if you can test this. FDA say that these data do not lead to the protocol being followed. And when we had done it, we found there was no problem. So this student made this particular data without mentioning the name of the company as her master's project and published a paper out of it. So FDA says not good enough evidence. And we felt that's not true. So if you simply look at the critical threshold for amoxicillin is 10 parts per billion. And we saw that at 10 parts per billion, 29 out of 29 samples were caught. So if you concentrate only on that one set, it turns out that the lower limit on the confidence interval of on sensitivity is 0.902. So simply concentrating on 10 parts per billion, what's the story there? Forget about the, and don't do a dose response curve, just concentrate on that. We did not see any problem. But then FDA says you need to do a dose response analysis. That is, you start looking at everything. What's the behavior of your test at 0, 2, 4, 5, 6, etc. So we ran, so the student actually, she ran variety of binary response regression models. And she finds that when you run the logistic regression model, the lower limit on sensitivity was 0.8975. Well, it's below 90%. But it's almost 0.90. This is what FDA did. They said that after factoring in statistical fluctuation, your sensitivity is only 87%. So that's why they failed it. But if you use some other model, it's 0.9375, and then there were a couple of other models too. So what do you do now? If you use the FDA method, the product fails. If you use this method, the product passes. That method, the product passes. So whose word are you going to go with? Well, FDA is the boss, so you have to go with their word. But then the student actually also examined the, when you fit a regression model, you also look at the quality of fit. And she found that the best fit was with the Gompertz model. And so we said that the worst fit was by Probit model, the one that FDA was using. So I tried to argue with the statistician at FDA that, well, look, your method had the worst fit, and you are holding this company to that method. And they said, no, we cannot do this. You know, this company has resources, they can hire you, but there are a lot of other smaller companies, they cannot afford that. So we just make one protocol. Everybody has to follow that. And we thought, that doesn't make sense. So the student presented that paper at a conference, and then the paper got published in a journal, Quality Improvement Through Statistical Methods. And when the reprints came, I sent a copy of that to the FDA statistician. And within a month, he issued a notification to the entire milk industry in the United States that from now on, don't just do Probit. You run these five models, whichever has the best fit, go with that. And if that method says pass, it's a pass. If that method says fail, it's a fail. I consider that to be, that gave us, or me, the best recognition actually, but there was hardly any research in that. It was just basically use of, statistical methodology in the correct way. So the company was very happy. Of course, they never argued with FDA. They could have taken FDA to court, but they didn't because they deal with them all the time. But they felt vindicated at the end that this is how statistics can help. Let me tell you two more case studies. I don't know how am I doing on time, Matt, but I'll try to go through this a little quickly. Now, this is interesting. And this kind of thing happens all the time. How do you prove in a court of law that age discrimination may have occurred, or gender discrimination or race discrimination might have occurred? How do you prove that? So there is this company called United Technology. It's a Dow Jones company, actually, major company. And one of their plants in the state of Maine, there were a total of 183 employees, and five of them were laid off, and the other 178 were not. And among the laid off, there was this guy, 62 years old engineer. So he decided to sue United Technology that I'm being fired not because of my performance, but I'm being fired because of my age. I'm 62 years old. Now, how do you make a case? So when the attorneys approached me, they said, can you look at the story? So I started here. I looked at the ages of all the people who were working there and their performance scores. And it turns out that people who were laid off, they were 62 years old, 61, 44, 53, 45, and I could not list 178 numbers of this kind. But how do you make a case of age discrimination? Well, we started off with this, that average age of those who were laid off was 53 and those who were not laid off was 45. Now, mathematically, 53 is always greater than 45. But statistically, 53 may not be greater than 45 because the word there is significantly greater, not just greater. So the question was that, is this significantly larger than this? If you can argue that, well, there is some life in our story. And so we ran two tests. It's a two group. There's a fired group and non-fired group. So you can do a two sample t-test or you could do a non-parametric version of it. This is what we did. And the defense did this test, the Wilcoxon rank sum test. We did this test. And I have to tell you this, even though time is a problem. In America, when you go to court, there's no surprise element there. In India, you watch films and the lawyers at the very last minute, they'll pull something out of their pocket and throw at you. But what about this? It cannot happen in the United States. You have to share your evidence with the other side. So we had shared with them our t-test story. They shared with us their rank sum test story. And they argued that, well, the statistical threshold has not been reached. Because remember, 5% is the threshold. And their p-value is 0.058. And our p-value was 0.020. So then the court, they tried to claim that their process itself is flawed. They should not be using a t-test. They should be using a non-parametric method. And according to that, they don't have evidence. So the attorneys actually pulled out old cases of this guy where he himself had used t-test in similar situations. So that was one problem that the court found very damaging. But the big deal was that actually, I don't know how many of you deal with statistics, but in statistics, you can have a two-sided analysis or you can have a one-sided analysis. Many people actually believe that a two-sided confidence interval or a two-sided test, they should be banned from literature. There should be no place for those things. You should always stay with one-sided. So we argued in court that, look, we are not saying that the age is different. We are saying that those who are fired are significantly older. So our test is one-sided, not a two-sided test. And therefore, even if you go with this guy, the two-sided p-value is 0.058, the one-sided p-value will be 0.029. And therefore, when you look at that analysis, even their analysis is saying that those who were fired were significantly older. So at least, you know, you get the judge's interest in this story. And you can do more. We run a logistic regression analysis where we the final response is fired or not fired, and the feed in the person's age. And when you do that, the p-value comes out to be 0.028 for the predictor age. And that shows that the company's firing or not firing decision had something to do with age. And when they realize that, they've really lost the case. They asked me a question at the end of the trial. So, Professor, did you prove that United Technologies discriminated against Mr. Currier, the engineer who brought the case? Again, the wording was, have you proved that they discriminated against him? I said, no, I did not prove that. And after that, they won't let me speak further. So it was a lot of struggle for me to be able to say that, but what I have proved is that their firing and not firing decision was not age neutral. Age had something to do with it. And therefore, this guy, you know, he won the case and he got the actual compensatory damages of about $500,000. But the big, you know, loot, if that's the word, happens when they get punitive damages. So he got zero in punitive damages, but he got more than $500,000 in compensatory damages, like the lost pay and things like that. So there are stories of this kind. I have one more case study, but again, I think time may not be on my side. But these kinds of things happen all the time. And statistic professors, they are called upon sometime on very short notice, because people are presenting these evidences and the attorneys want to understand. It's becoming actually more and more common that attorneys, they take statistics courses. They try to get a statistics degree or at least do a certificate so that they have some initial idea as to what's going on. So I don't know if You were kind of let down by the buildup that Dr. Joshi had said that I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. Well, I did not do really much, but I just wanted to share with you the practical side of statistics. And somehow, unfortunately in India, you know, it doesn't happen. Once I was talking to a high court judge in Delhi, there was some relation I had, and I was telling her this story, and she said, Dr. Gupta, in here, it's all anecdotal evidence. Nobody presents in court scientific evidence. So will you be willing to give a talk to the judges and attorneys? She's going to pool together, and she may still do that in Delhi, and I'll be happy to speak to them that how evidence could be analyzed statistically. It may not be all the time, but in many times it can be done, and all the big legal cases, statistics is at the core of the decisions there. So let me stop here and give you guys a chance to ask questions or make comments.
Thank you.
Yes.
So, is this number 5, is it like, does it fit the case for best statistics, or is it, what if there were 3, what if there were 2? When do you choose that, okay, I have to do statistical analysis?
Yeah. Well, there are two kinds of tests. There are these parametric tests, and then there are non-parametric tests. So, first of all, I have seen studies where you are not allowed to collect data on more than 3 subjects. For example, some of the medical tests, you have to sacrifice a rabbit in order to study something, and they will not give you permission to sacrifice more than 3 rabbits. So you have just 3 rabbits which you sacrificed and got something. Now how do you make a story out of it, because it's just 3? And even after the sample being too small, if you believe that the environment for a parametric analysis is there, no harm in doing it. But if the parametric story breaks down, you can go to these more robust non-parametric methods, which are less powerful. So this is what the guy was trying to say, that why am I using the parametric test, 5 versus 178? And the attorneys found him doing exactly the same thing in several cases like 10, 15 years ago. So he floated this non-parametric thing. But even with his method, the argument went against him. So 5 is, you know, it's not too small. I've seen something smaller than that. But to be more careful, one could do a different kind of analysis. Even non-parametric methods require some assumption. There are these tests, permutation tests. So what a permutation test does is that you have these 183 people in the mix. I want to break that 183 into 2 groups, 5 and 178, right? And you let the computer run this. That look at all possible breakups of 183, 5 on one side, 178 on one side. How often do you see a discrepancy as big or bigger? And if that discrepancy or that probability happens to be less than 5%, you have your case. So even with a small sample, it can be done, but it's a matter of like which test do you apply. I need to come closer to you. Yes.
Like at 95% confidence level, there needed to be 30 samples for the p-value to be significant, right? So if you want to report at a higher confidence level, does it mean that you have to report more sampling?
Well, I gave that example of 30, not because that's what was needed. I was just saying that 20 out of 20 was not enough. 25 out of 25 would not have been enough, but 30 out of 30 is enough. But I did not calculate that based on any 95% confidence interval or anything. There's a parallel problem of how large a sample you need to take in order for certain things to be detected. So that's called power analysis. So a lot of time, people have to do that power analysis ahead of time, that given that situation, how large a sample would be enough, so that you don't regret at the end that power analysis says that you should have taken 47. And you took only 42, and now you have messed up your study. So I did not calculate 30, I was just trying to show that people might think that 25 out of 25 is great evidence, but it may not be all that great. So 30 out of 30 would be fine.
But that has associated sensitivity value also, right? P-value.
Yes.
P-value turns out to be different as an
increase. Yes, it does. So the question is, how likely is it that something like this could have happened just by chance? And so that's the trick. But the sample size 30 was not based on any calculation. This was just, you know, I was just trying to show that the threshold is not met here, but it's met here. So I'm not suggesting that a sample of size 30 in general is good. Even though for many years, the FDA protocol was that take a sample of size 30. And if all 30 are fine, you are good. But then I started telling this company that what if, it's a statistical process, what if you misfire one? Are you going to be in trouble now? So the process sort of evolved. There should be some room for error. There can be a bad luck situation that there was only one bad kit which happened in your sample. Now you don't want your product to be wasted. Actually, one of the other things is that in one case, we found that the protocol is not met. Now, what do you do? Do you destroy the entire product? Well, there's something called a double testing, meaning, like you know that if an enemy aircraft is coming in and you install one gun to kill it, now that one gun may misfire or may not be able to shoot it down. But we know that if you put two guns, then the probability of catching the plane is higher. If you put three guns, the probability of catching the plane is higher. I mean, how likely is it? If the accuracy of a gun is 90%, meaning 10% of the time it's going to miss it. But if there are two guns, what's the probability that they both miss it? It's only 1%. So probability that one of them will catch it is 99%. So you can raise the sensitivity level of a process by doing multiple testing. So in that one case, I suggested to this company that change the label and tell in the label in bold that the process says you have to do double testing. And so that way they can still get some money for their product. Otherwise the whole thing, and this is legal because their test is not just testing one time, their test is double test. So that's the test.
And everybody has to buy two of the kits.
Yes. Actually, in many cases, you know, these, it's very common anyway, like the pregnancy test. You don't rely with this one. If you find that you have tested positive for being pregnant, well, test one more time. So this double testing is a common thing, but it's just a matter of realizing it. A quick response might be, well, sorry, what can I do? Just throw it away. But you can still salvage something out of it. And there are many situations where this, even triple testing I've seen, the label will say you have to test it three times. And they will lower the price of the kit and so on to get something out of it.
Okay, no more questions. Once again, let us thank
Well, thank you very much for listening.